allowing us to record on its surface whatever we choose. Paper records. My grandfather's tales from when he lived in Germany at the outbreak of the Second World War absorbed me as a child, but now that he is gone, the documents he left behind must tell the stories for themselves. There is nothing quite like holding a piece of history in your hand, such as a letter that he wrote to the British Home Office in an attempt to extract my father from Belgium, fearing a German invasion. Paper yellows with age for two reasons. If it is made from cheap, low-grade mechanical pulp, it will still contain some lignin. Lignin reacts with oxygen in the presence of light to create chromophores, meaning literally color carriers, which turn the paper yellow as they increase in concentration. This type of paper is used for cheap and disposable paper products, and is why newspapers yellow quickly in light. It used to be fairly common to increase the textural quality of paper by coating it with aluminum sulfate, a chemical compound that is used primarily to purify water. But what wasn't appreciated at the time was that this treatment creates acidic conditions. This causes the cellulose fibers to react with hydrogen ions, which results in another form of yellowing. It also decreases the strength of the paper. Large numbers of books from the 19th and 20th centuries were printed on this so-called acid paper and can now be easily identified in bookshops and libraries by their bright yellow appearance. Even non-acid paper is susceptible to this aging, just at a slower rate. The aging process also results in the formation of a wide range of volatile, meaning that they evaporate easily, organic molecules, which are responsible for the smell of old paper and books. Libraries are now actively researching the chemistry of book smell to see if they can use it to help them monitor and preserve large collections of books. Although it is a smell of decay, to many it is nevertheless perceived to be a pleasant one. The yellowing and disintegration of paper are disturbing, and yet, like all antiques, paper gains an authenticity and power from its patina of age. The sensual impressions of old paper allow you to enter the past much more readily, providing a portal to that world. Photographic paper. My grandfather's attempt to petition the British Home Office on behalf of his son was a success, and this was the result. My father's German identification card, which was stamped by the Immigration Office on his way out of Brussels on December 4, 1939. My father was 9 years old at the time, and in the photo he appears oblivious to the danger of his situation. The Germans invaded in May 1940. It is hard to overestimate the effect of photographic paper on human culture. It provided a way for identification to be standardized and verified, and, in this sense, has been accepted as the final arbiter of what we look like and, by extension, who we actually are. The almost fascistic authority of the photograph originates from its apparently unbiased nature, which is the result of the way the image is captured. And that lies with the paper itself. Since the chemicals in it record the dark and light patches of your face automatically, by simply reacting with the light reflected from it, the image itself is seen to be impartial. The black and white photo of my dad started out as a white piece of paper coated in a fine gel containing silver bromide and silver chloride molecules. In 1939, when the light bouncing off my dad entered the camera lens and fell onto the photographic paper, it transformed the silver bromide and chloride molecules into little crystals of silver metal, which appear as specks of grey on the paper. If the paper had been removed from the camera at this point, the image of my dad would have been lost. This is because all the white areas where there was no image would be flooded with light, causing them instantly to react as well and creating a completely black photo. To prevent this, the photo was fixed in a dark room with a chemical that washed away the unreacted silver halides from the paper. This left only the silver crystals embedded in the layer of gel on the surface of the paper. Once dried and processed, it was the image of my dad that enabled him, rather than some other boy, to escape the concentration camps. My dad is still here to tell the tale, but one day there will only be the photograph to remind us of this moment in time, a material fact of history that contributes to our collective memory. Of course, photographs are not really unbiased, but then neither are memories. Books. The transition from an oral culture, in which knowledge was handed down through stories, songs, and apprenticeships, to a literate one, based on the written word, was held back for centuries by the lack of suitable writing material. Stone and clay tablets were used, but they were prone to fracture and were bulky and heavy to transport. Wood suffers from splitting and is susceptible to decay. Wall paintings are static and space is limited. The invention of paper, said to be one of the four great inventions of the Chinese, solved these problems, but it wasn't until the Romans replaced the scroll with the codex, or as we call it now, the book, that the material reached its full potential. That was 2,000 years ago, and it is still a dominant form of the written word. That paper, a much softer material than either stone or wood, won out as the guardian of the written word is a remarkable material story. It is the thinness of paper that proves to be one of its great advantages, allowing it the flexibility to survive continuous handling, but when stacked together in book form, becoming stiff and strong, essentially a reformed block of wood. With the use of hard covers to hold it all together, the book is a fortress for words for thousands of years. The genius of this so-called codex format, a stack of papers bound to a single spine and sandwiched between covers, and the reason why it usurped the scroll, is that it allows for text on both sides of the paper, and yet still provides a continuous reading experience. Other cultures achieved something similar with the concertina format, forming a stack by repeatedly folding one continuous sheet of paper in on itself. But the advantage of the codex, with its individual pages, is that many scribes could work on the same book at the same time, and after the invention of the printing press, many copies of the same book could be created at the same time. As biology had already discovered, the speedy copying of information is the most effective way of preserving it. The Bible is said to be one of the first books created in this new format, one that suited preachers of Christianity because it allowed them to locate the text relevant to their purpose using page numbers instead of laboriously searching through a whole scroll. This form of random access memory prefigured the digital age and may yet outlast it. Wrapping paper. Paper is not only useful for preserving information. In its role as a wrapping material, paper also does a good job of obscuring it. What would birthdays be like without this material, which performs the role of building excitement and anticipation better than all others? I have received presents wrapped in cloth or hidden in a cupboard, but nothing has the magic of wrapping paper. A present really isn't a present until it is wrapped in paper. It is the paper that, by concealing and revealing an object, ritualizes the act of giving and receiving, turning that object into a gift. This is not just a cultural association. The material has fundamental properties that make it ideal for this role. Paper's mechanical properties lend themselves to folding and bending. The cellulose fibers of which it is made can be partially snapped in the area of maximum bend, allowing a permanent crease to form, while sufficient fibers remain intact for the material not to crack and fall apart. Indeed, in this state it pretty much maintains its ability to resist being pulled apart, but it can also be torn easily and accurately along the crease if a point of weakness, a small initial tear, is opened up. This winning combination of mechanical properties allows it to assume the shape of any object through creasing and folding, hence the art of origami. There are very few materials as good. Metal foils can hold a crease, but control of the crease is somewhat more difficult. Plastic sheeting doesn't tend to hold a crease at all, unless it is very soft, in which case it lacks the rigidity and formality required of a good wrapping material. So it is its ability to hold a crease while remaining stiff that makes paper uniquely suited to this purpose. Wrapping a present with paper gives it a crispness and pristineness that emphasize the newness and value of the present inside. Paper is strong enough to protect the present when it is sent through the mail, but so weak that even a baby can rip it open. That moment of opening transports the object inside from obscurity to celebrity in a few seconds. The unwrapping of a present is akin to the act of birth. A new life for the object begins. Receipts. I have a receipt from a trip to the shop Marks & Spencer 3 days before my son Laszlo was born in 2011. Laszlo's mum, Ruby, had a difficult pregnancy. This was partly because she developed a craving for beer, which she would not allow herself to drink, but insisted instead that I do it for her. Some days the cravings would get so bad that, as the M&S receipt shows, I would have to drink 3 bottles of beer per night, with Ruby following every sip with a sometimes longing but mostly accusing gaze. Laszlo had almost been born 2 weeks earlier, but in a turn of events that none of us can satisfactorily explain, he refused to emerge. After 24 hours, we were sent home from hospital and advised that Ruby's eating hot curries might encourage Laszlo to leave the womb. 2 weeks later, we had got a little tired of the nightly curries that I was sent out to retrieve. I do remember liking best the lamb Rogan Josh, and I see we got it again that night. The logic was that the spicy diet would make life uncomfortable for Laszlo, but in truth I feel that it was we who suffered more from the digestive challenge of our extreme diet. Laszlo, by the way, is now age 2 and loves spicy food. Despite the memories of uncomfortable times the receipt evokes, I am glad I still have it. It encapsulates a different kind of intimacy from that of a photo or even a diary, where these seemingly mundane details of our lives can get lost. Sadly, the receipt will not survive long enough for Laszlo to read it. It is already fading, as the thermal paper on which it is printed degrades over time. The reason for this is that printing on thermal paper does not mean adding ink to it. Rather, the ink is already encapsulated within the paper, in the form of a so-called leuco dye and an acid. The act of printing requires only a spark to heat up the paper so that the acid and dye react with each other, converting the dye from a transparent state into a dark pigment. It is this cunning paper technology that ensures that cash registers never run out of ink. But over time, the pigment reverts to its transparent state, and so the ink fades, taking with it the evidence of curry and beer dinners. Nevertheless, M&S enthusiastically encourages us to please retain for your records, something that I have dutifully done. Envelopes. That flash of inspiration that hits you when you are on the bus or in a cafe requires an immediate physical expression. It needs to be noted down urgently before it is forgotten. But where? You are away from your desk and your notebooks. You search your pockets for some scrap of paper and find a letter, an electricity bill perhaps, but it will do. There is enough room on the back of the envelope for you to outline your idea. So you do, following a long line of famous scientists and engineers who have throughout history claimed the back of an envelope as an important theater of ideas. The physicist Enrico Fermi is famous not only for solving fundamental questions of science in the restricted space on the back of an envelope, but for formalizing that process. This new form of calculation, the scientific equivalent of a haiku, is called an order of magnitude calculation. This way of looking at the world prizes above all not exact answers, but answers that are easily understandable and say something fundamental about the world using only the information available on a bus. They must be accurate by an order of magnitude, which is to say that they should be correct within a factor of 2 or 3, i.e. the true value could be as little as a third or as much as 3 times the result, but no more or less. Such calculations are pretty approximate, but they were used by Fermi and others to demonstrate a paradox. The vast number of stars and planets in the universe should provide abundant opportunities for other intelligent life to form, and therefore a great likelihood of our having encountered it. And yet, given that we have not encountered it, that same vast number is precisely what shows how rare intelligent life is. As a kid, I was so obsessed with stories of famous scientists who solved fundamental problems on the back of envelopes that I used to bring old envelopes with me to school and practice solving problems on the back of them. It was a kind of martial art for the mind, requiring only a pen and envelope. It helped me not just to clarify my thoughts, but also to pass exams. The first question on my Oxford University entrance physics exam was, "Estimate the number of atoms on the Earth." I smiled when I saw this. It was classic back-of-the-envelope territory. It is the sheer ubiquity of the paper envelope that makes it so useful as a theater of ideas. Even if you haven't got a notebook to sketch out your ideas or any money to buy one, a free envelope is sure to drop through your letterbox sooner rather than later. Paper bags. There is a particular nervousness I feel when buying expensive clothes. They look and feel alien when I try them on in the shop, and no matter how many smiles and nods of approval the shop assistants give me, I am never certain whether I should spend the money. When I say yes, though, I am rewarded by something of which I never tire. It comes out first in its flat-pack condition, but then its bottom is pushed out and it makes that glorious sound of thunder as the concertinaed paper sides are deployed into their upright positions. There it sits on the shop counter like a butterfly recently emerged from its chrysalis, perfect, elegant, and poised. Suddenly my purchase seems right, now that the clothes have been allocated this special receptacle to chaperone them back home. In stark contrast to toilet paper, in this guise paper is a refined and stylish material, light, stiff, and strong. But the strength is an illusion. The cellulose fibers that make up the paper bag are no longer accompanied by the lignin that glued them together when they were part of a tree. Although hydrogen bonds form between the fibers during the drying stage, which give the paper some strength, they have to be reinforced with synthetic adhesives. Even then, it is a weak material with little water resistance. Once wet, the fibers lose their hydrogen bonds, and the paper bag disintegrates fast. It is perhaps the very fragility of paper bags that makes them appealing for their task. Expensive clothes tend to be light and fragile, and maybe the fact that paper is all that is needed for their journey home reinforces this. Paper also has high cultural status. It speaks of the craft of making, of the handmade object, associations that fit with tailor-made clothes. Again, this is an illusion in the case of paper. It is itself a fully-fledged industrial product, and quite an environmentally costly one, too. The impact in terms of energy usage of a single-use paper bag has been found to be greater than that of a plastic bag, so they are an indulgence, one designed to celebrate your triumphal purchases. They mark the moment of arriving home by banging inevitably into the door frames as you struggle down corridors, their soundtrack of soft rumbling thunder filling you with excitement and pride. Glossy paper. The look and feel of paper turn out to be of the utmost importance and the secret to why it is so useful as a material. It can be transformed from rustic to official, from retro to glamorous, simply by changing the surface layer. Controlling these aesthetic considerations is vital to the economic fortunes of commercial publications. The science of this transformation is a highly advanced topic of research. The shininess, smoothness, and weight of the paper have all been shown to be crucial to the success of certain magazines, but less appreciated is the importance of stiffness, or rather, the ease with which the paper will bend. Too bendy, and the paper gives an impression of cheapness. Too stiff, and it seems self-important. This stiffness is controlled by the addition of sizings, fine powder additives such as kaolin and calcium carbonate that, among other things, reduce the paper's ability to absorb moisture, causing inks to dry on its surface rather than infuse its fibers, while also allowing the whiteness of the paper to be controlled. These powders, and the binders that bond them to the cellulose fibers of the paper, create what's known as a composite matrix. A familiar example of a composite material is concrete, which is similarly composed of two distinct materials, cement, which is the matrix or binder, and aggregate, which is known as a reinforcement. Control of this matrix determines the weight, strength, and stiffness of the paper. It is not without problems, though. It turns out that the look and feel of popular glamour magazines require a combination of stiffness and low weight, which turns the paper into a cutting instrument. The paper is so thin that its edges have the sharpness of a razor. Under most circumstances, it bends rather than cuts, but if you run your finger down one sheet at the right angle, it produces a paper cut. These cuts are notoriously painful, but it is not quite clear why. It may be because they tend to occur on the fingers, which have a high density of sensory receptors, so they seem more painful than cuts elsewhere on the body. Of course, it's a price worth paying, or so the millions of people who buy glossy magazines every week seem to think. Tickets. When the thickness of paper is increased, it loses its flexibility, becoming stiffer and stiffer until at some point it is stiff enough to hold itself up and not bend under its own weight. At this point, it takes on new cultural roles, one of which is the permission to travel. Bus, train, and plane tickets the world over are made from thick paper called card. All forms of human transport are engineered to be stiff, and perhaps this may be the reason why the mechanical stiffness of card is so well suited to represent travel. Bendy cars are not just unusual, they are dysfunctional, because if a car chassis is not rigid enough, then the high stresses it encounters will misalign the drive mechanism. Similarly, if a train bends too much, it will jump off the track, and if airplane wings sag too much under their own weight, they cease to create lift. Thus, the engineering of trains, planes, and automobiles requires an almost fetishistic devotion to stiffness. Apart from stiffness, the increased solidity and strength of card imbue the ticket with a sense of authority. It is, after all, a type of temporary passport that grants a right of passage. These days, a ticket must be inspected by machines as well as humans, and so it is important that the ticket is strong enough not to become bent and crumpled while being handled, stuffed in pockets, and slid in and out of wallets. The world of travel is dominated by stiff, hard machines, and card reflects that back to us. Funnily enough, as cars and airplanes have gotten lighter and more efficient, so tickets have mirrored this, becoming thinner and thinner. Soon, they will probably disappear altogether, becoming part of our digital lives. Banknotes. Money is at its most seductive in its paper form. There are few more pleasing things in life than typing your PIN into a hole in the wall and being served up lovely, crisp banknotes. In sufficient quantity, they are a passport to anything and anywhere in the world, and this freedom is intoxicating. They are also the most sophisticated pieces of paper that have ever been made, which they need to be because they are a literal material manifestation of the trust we all have in the whole economic system. To prevent forgeries, the paper has a number of tricks up its sleeve. First of all, it is not made of wood cellulose like other paper, but from cotton. This not only gives it greater strength and stops it disintegrating in the rain and washing machines, but it changes the sound of the paper. The crisp sound of paper money is one of its most notable characteristics. It is also one of the best anti-counterfeit measures because it is hard to fake with wood-based paper. The particular texture of cotton paper is something that bank machines monitor. Humans are very sensitive to it too. If there is any doubt about a banknote, there is an easy chemical test that can confirm whether it's cotton or not. This is done in many shops using an iodine pen. When used on cellulose-based paper, the iodine reacts with the starch in the cellulose to create a pigment and so appears black. When the same pen is used on cotton paper, there is no starch for the iodine to react with, and no mark appears. This basic measure allows shops to protect themselves from counterfeits produced using color photocopiers. But the paper has got another trick up its sleeve, watermarking. This is a pattern or picture that is embedded in the paper, but can only be seen when light is transmitted through the paper. In other words, when you hold the banknote up to the light. Despite the name, this is not a water stain or an ink of any sort. It is engineered by creating small changes in the density of the cotton, so that different parts of the note look lighter and darker to produce a pattern, or, in the case of U.S. bills greater than $5, the heads of presidents. Paper money is an endangered species. Money is mostly electronic these days, and only a small percentage of transactions are carried out in cash. These are mostly low-value transactions, and electronic cash is poised to replace these, too. Electronic paper. Once information could be written down on paper, libraries became the most important archives of the accumulated knowledge and wisdom of a civilization. This crucial role of the library survived until very recently. Access to a great library was the key to scholarship in any university, and access to a local library was seen as a basic human right in modern societies. The digital revolution has changed the landscape considerably. Now it is possible to give everyone a complete set of the written works of the human race via a computer. But there has been a lot of resistance to the move from the physical to the digital book. Most of this is not about access, but about sensual delight in the act of reading. Suddenly, as happens so often in the history of engineering, a technology that had been around for a while but had little or no mass application came into its own. Electronic paper is a type of flat screen that displays text using real ink and is designed to be read with reflective light bouncing off it in the same way as a physical book. The difference is that electronic paper can be controlled digitally to display any text required almost instantly. When integrated with a computer chip, it can store and display millions of books. The technology relies on the ink being made into a form of the so-called Janus particle. Each particle of ink is dyed so that it is dark on one side and white on the other. The two sides are given opposite electric charges, and so each pixel on the electronic paper can be made dark or white by applying the appropriate electric charge. They are named Janus particles after the Roman god of transitions, who is depicted as having two faces and is often associated with doors and gates. Because the Janus particles are physical ink and need to physically rotate when the text is changed, they cannot be switched as rapidly as the liquid crystal display of an iPad or smartphone, and so, at the moment, they are unable to show movies and other snazzy stuff. They have a pleasing retro quality, which perhaps suits the written word. The Janus particle has made reading e-books much more like the experience of reading a physical book, at least in terms of the appearance of the words on the page. It could yet be the future of the written word. However, it is unlikely that electronic paper will completely supplant books while it lacks paper's distinctive smell, feel, and sound, since it is this multisensual physicality of reading that is one of its great attractions. People love books, more perhaps than they love the written word. They use them as a way to define who they are and to provide physical evidence of their values. Books on shelves and on tables are a kind of internal marketing exercise, reminding us who we are and who we want to be. We are physical beings, so it perhaps makes sense for us to identify and express our values using physical objects, which we like to touch and smell as well as read. Newspapers. There is something about a printed photograph or newspaper headline that makes the event it describes more real than in any other form of news reporting. Perhaps this is because there is an undeniable reality to the newspaper itself. It is a real material object. That authenticity rubs off on the news. It can be pointed to, underlined, cut out, pinned on notice boards, stuck in a scrapbook, or archived in libraries. The news becomes an artifact, frozen in time. The event may be long gone, but it lives on as an indisputable fact because of its material presence, even if it is untrue. In contrast, news websites seem ephemeral. Although they too are archived, there is no unique physical component to point to as evidence of the information they convey. For this reason, there is a sense in which they can be more easily manipulated and that history itself could be altered. At the same time, it is precisely this immediacy and fluidity of content that makes the digital media so exciting. The news website is in tune with an age that sees history as much less monolithic than previous eras once did. Digital news websites are potentially much more democratic, too. For while a physical newspaper requires huge printing presses and a distribution network linking trains, planes, trucks, shops, and ultimately newspaper sellers, in the digital world, a single person can communicate with the whole world with the aid of a single computer and without requiring a single tree to be cut down. The move away from printed newspapers will change not just the internal dialogue of countries and cities, but social habits too. The rustle of the paper will no longer be part of the ritual of Sunday afternoons. Newspapers will no longer sit underneath muddy boots or lounge folded up on train station benches. It will no longer protect floors from paint drips or be wrapped around precious objects to protect them. It will no longer be crumpled into a ball to light a fire or be thrown cheekily at an unsuspected sibling. None of these uses of newspaper are essential in themselves, but taken as a whole, they paint a picture of a very domestic, useful, and much-loved material. A material that will be missed. Love letters. Despite the march of digital technologies, it is hard to believe that paper will completely disappear as a means of communication. For some messages, we trust it above all other media. There is nothing that quite grips the stomach while simultaneously making your heart skip than a letter from your beloved arriving by post. Phone calls are fine and intimate, text messages and emails are instantaneous and gratifying, but to hold in your hands the very material that your beloved touched, and to breathe in their sweetness from the paper, is truly the stuff of love. It is a communication of more than words. There is a permanence, a physical solidity to soothe those of an insecure nature. It can be read and reread over and over again. It physically takes up space in your life. The paper itself becomes a simulacrum of the loved one's skin. It smells of their scent, and their writing is as much an expression of their unique nature as a fingerprint. A love letter is not faked and is not cut and pasted. What is it about paper that allows words to be expressed that might otherwise be kept secret? They are written in a private moment, and as such, paper lends itself to sensual love, the act of writing being one fundamentally of touch, of flow, of flourish, of sweet asides and little sketches, an individuality that is free from the mechanics of a keyboard. The ink becomes a kind of blood that demands honesty and expression. It pours onto the page, allowing thoughts to flow. Letters make splitting up harder, too, since, like photographs, they echo forever on the page. For one whose heart is broken, this is a cruelty, and for those who have moved on, it is a stinging rebuke of infidelity, or, at the very least, a thorn of inconstancy in the side of their constructed personality. Paper, though, as a carbon-based material, has a bright solution for those wanting to be released from such a torture. A match. 3. Fundamental. One spring day in 2009, I was on my way to pick up a loaf of bread from the market when I turned the corner to find that the Southwark Towers was gone. All 25 floors of a classic 1970s office block had been demolished. I racked my brain to remember when I had last seen it. Surely it was last week when I had nipped out to make this exact same journey. I came over a little queasy. Was I losing my grip, or had building demolition got a lot more efficient? Either way, I felt less sure of myself, a little less significant. I had liked the Southwark Towers, which had automatic doors that were made when such things were groovy. Now the high-rise was gone, leaving a bigger hole in the street and my life than I was expecting. Nothing looked quite the same. I made my way to the brightly coloured hoardings that now surrounded the empty space it had left behind. On the side of the hoardings, a notice announced that Europe's tallest building, the Shard, was to be built here. It had a picture of a giant pointed glass skyscraper that would rise from the ashes of the Southwark Towers over London Bridge Station. The text extolled a vision of this new construction dominating the London skyline for decades to come. I felt annoyed and worried. What if this giant glass phallus became a target for terrorists? What if it was attacked like the Twin Towers and collapsed, killing me and my family? I consulted Google Maps and reassured myself that even if this 330-meter building were to tip over sideways, it would not reach my flat. At a stretch, it might reach the Shakespeare Tavern, a pub nearby, but one I didn't frequent. Nevertheless, there was the suffocating dust cloud it would create, I muttered as I walked in an apocalyptic mood to get bread. Over the next few years, I would watch this huge skyscraper being constructed on my doorstep. I would witness extraordinary sights and amazing feats of engineering, but mostly I would get to know concrete very, very well. They started by digging a huge hole, and when I say huge, I mean enormous. Week after week, on my bread-collecting mission, I would peer through the viewing window in the side of the hoardings to see the progress of gigantic machines that were scooping out the dirt, digging ever deeper, as if they were mining for something. But what they were digging out was clay, clay that had been deposited there for hundreds of thousands of years by the Thames River. It was the same thick clay that has always been used to fire the bricks to make the houses and warehouses from which the City of London is built. But this clay was not going to be used to build the Shard. One day, once all of this clay had been removed, they poured 700 truckloads of concrete into the hole. This would make the foundations that would hold up the enormous skyscraper and prevent the 72 floors above and the 20,000 people who would inhabit them from sinking into the clay. They filled the enormous hole with concrete, layer after layer, building up floor after subterranean floor, until there was no gigantic hole anymore, just an underground cathedral of poured concrete, which was now slowly becoming fully solid. It was nicely done and impressively speedy, which was important because for cost reasons they had already started to build the tower before they finished its foundations. "How long will the concrete take to dry, do you think?" a man with a dog asked me, while we were both peering through the viewing window of the hoardings. "I dunno," I lied. My lie was intended to cut the conversation short, which it did. It was a habitual lie, born of living in London and finding ways of politely avoiding talking to strangers. Especially as I didn't know how he or his dog would take to my beginning our acquaintance by correcting him. Concrete doesn't dry out. Quite the opposite. Water is an ingredient of concrete. When concrete sets, it is reacting with water, initiating a chain of chemical reactions to form a complex microstructure deep within the material, so that this material, despite having a lot of water locked up inside it, is not just dry, but waterproof. The setting of concrete is, at its heart, an ingenious piece of chemistry, which has powdered rock as its active ingredient. Not every type of rock will work. If you want to make your own concrete, you need some calcium carbonate, which is the main constituent of limestone, a rock formed from the compressed layers of living organisms over millions of years, and then fused together by the heat and pressure of the movement of the Earth's crust. You also need some rock containing silicate, silicate being a compound containing silicon and oxygen and constituting roughly 90% of the Earth's crust, for which some form of clay will do. Grinding these ingredients up and mixing them together with water won't get you anywhere, unless you want to create a sludgy mud. In order to create within them the essential ingredient that will react with the water, you need to free them from their current chemical bonds. This is not easy. These bonds are extremely stable, which is why rocks do not easily dissolve or react with many things. On the contrary, they last for millions of years. The trick is to heat them to a temperature of about 1450 degrees Celsius. This is a temperature far exceeding that of an average wood or coal fire, which is between 600 and 800 degrees Celsius, if it is glowing red or yellow hot. At 1450 degrees Celsius, a fire will glow white hot, with no tinge of red or even yellow in the flames, but instead a hint of blue. It is so bright it is unnerving and almost painful to look at. At these temperatures, rock starts to fall apart and reform to create a family of compounds called calcium silicates. It's a family because there are lots of minor impurities that can change the outcome of what you get. To make concrete, aluminum and iron-rich rocks are the magic ingredients, but only in the correct proportions. Once it has all cooled down, the result is a powder, the grey-white colour of the moon. If you put your hands through it, you find that it has the silky texture of ash. There is something atavistic about it, but your hands soon feel dried out as if under a subtle type of attack. This is a very special material with a very dull name, cement. If you now add water to this powder, it sucks it up with ease and darkens. But instead of forming a slushy mud, which is what happens if you add water to most powdered rock, a series of chemical reactions takes place to form a gel. Gels are semi-solid and wobbly types of matter. The jelly served at children's parties is a gel, and so too is a lot of toothpaste. It doesn't slosh around like a liquid because it has an internal skeleton that prevents the liquid moving. In the case of jelly, this is created by the gelatin. In the case of cement, the skeleton is made up of calcium silicate hydrate fibrils, which are crystal-like entities that grow from the calcium and silicate molecules now dissolved in the water in a way that appears almost organic. So the gel that forms inside cement is constantly changing as the solid internal skeleton grows and further chemical reactions take place. As the fibrils grow and meet, they mesh together, forming bonds and locking in more and more of the water, until the whole mass transforms from a gel to a solid rock. These fibrils will bond not only to each other, but also to other rocks and stones, and this is how cement turns into concrete. Cement is used to bond together bricks to make houses and stones to make monuments, but in both cases it is wedged between the cracks as the minority component, an urban glue. When it is made into concrete by mixing it with small stones, which play the role of tiny bricks, it fulfills its potential to become a structural material. As with any chemical reaction, if you get the ratio of the ingredients wrong, then you get a mess. In the case of concrete, if you add too much water, there won't be enough calcium silicate from the cement powder to react with, and so water will be left over within the structure, which makes it weak. Similarly, if you add too little water, there will be unreacted cement left over, which again weakens the structure. It is usually human error of this sort that proves the undoing of concrete. Such poor concrete can go undiscovered, but then lead to catastrophe many years after the builders have departed. The extent of the devastation due to the 2010 earthquake in Haiti was blamed on shoddy construction and poor quality concrete. An estimated 250,000 buildings collapsed, killing more than 300,000 people and making a million more homeless. What is worse is that Haiti is by no means unusual. Such concrete time bombs are scattered throughout the world. Tracking down the origin of such human errors can be tricky, since from the exterior, the concrete looks fine. The supervising engineer of the building of JFK Airport noticed through routine tests that the concrete arriving on trucks before noon had good strength when it set, but that arriving just after noon was substantially weaker. Puzzled, he investigated all possible reasons for this, but was unable to find the answer until he resorted to following the truck delivering the concrete on its journey to the airport. He found that around noon the driver was in the habit of taking a break for lunch, and would hose the concrete with water before doing so in the belief that adding extra water would keep the concrete liquid for longer. While digging the foundations for the shard and its supporting structures, the engineers found evidence of a type of concrete that predates the modern stuff, Roman concrete. It was holding together the remains of a Roman bathhouse they found when they demolished my local fish and chip shop, which had resided next to the now ex-Southwark Towers. The Romans got lucky with concrete. Instead of having to experiment with heating up different combinations of ground-up rock to white-hot temperatures, they found ready-made cement in a place called Pozzuoli, just outside Naples. Pozzuoli stinks, literally. It took its name from the Latin putere, to stink, the smell coming from the sulfur in the volcanic sands nearby. The upside of the smell was that the region had been the recipient of lava and eruptions of ash and pumice for millions of years. This volcanic ash resulted from the superheating of silicate rock, which was then spewed out of a volcanic vent, a process suspiciously similar to that of making modern cement. All the Romans had to do was put up with the smell and mine the rock powder that had been accumulating for millions of years. This naturally made cement is slightly different from modern Portland cement and requires the addition of lime to make it set. But once they had worked this out and added stones for strength, they had in their hands for the first time in human history the fundamentally unique building material that is concrete. The composite nature of a brick building is part of its appeal. The brick itself is a unit of construction that is designed to fit in the hand, giving the whole a human scale. Concrete is fundamentally different from this building material because it starts off as a liquid. This means that buildings made from concrete can be poured, and what is created is a continuous structure, from the foundations to the roof, without any joins. The mantra of a concrete engineer is, you want foundations, we will pour you foundations. You want pillars, we will pour you pillars. You want a floor, we will pour you a floor. You want it twice the size? No problem. You want it curved? No problem. With concrete, if you can build the mold, you can create the structure. The power of the stuff is palpable and addictive to anyone who visits the building sites where the stuff is being made. Week after week, I would peer through the viewing hole on the side of the shard and be transfixed by what I saw. A building was growing out of the foundations. It was being poured into existence by human ants. Powdered rock and stones arrived at the site and were transformed by the simple addition of water into rock again. It is a philosophy as much as it is an engineering technique, completing a cycle that starts when the Earth's mantle creates rock and stone through mountain building, which is then mined by humans and transformed back into our own artificial mountains of rock, made to our own design, where we live and work. The existence of concrete feeds the ambition of engineers. Once the Romans had invented it, they realized that it would allow them to build the infrastructure of their empire. It allowed them to build ports wherever they wanted, because their concrete could set underwater. They could build aqueducts and bridges, too. the very infrastructure needed to transport the raw ingredients for concrete to wherever they were needed, instead of relying on local stone or clay. In this sense, concrete is ideally suited to empire building. The most impressive piece of Roman concrete engineering, however, is in its capital, the Dome of the Pantheon in Rome. Still standing today, it is 2,000 years old, but still the largest unreinforced concrete dome in the world. Although the Pantheon survived the fall of the Roman Empire, concrete as a material did not. There were no concrete structures for more than 1,000 years after the Romans stopped making it. The reason for this loss of the materials technology remains a mystery. Perhaps the material was lost because it was industrial in nature and needed an industrial empire to support it. Perhaps it was lost because it was not associated with a particular skill or craft, such as ironmongery, stonemasonry, or carpentry, and so was not handed down as a family trade. Or perhaps it was lost because Roman concrete, good as it was, did have one crucial flaw, a flaw that the Romans knew all about but could not solve. There are two ways of breaking a material. One is to break it plastically, which is what happens when, for example, you pull a piece of chewing gum apart. The material is able to rearrange itself and so flows and gets thinner in the middle until eventually it is separated into two pieces. This is what you need to do to break most metals, but it takes a lot of energy to get metals to flow like this, because you have to move a lot of dislocations, which is why they are such strong and tough materials. The other way of breaking a material is to create a crack through it, which is how a glass or a teacup breaks. Unable to flow in order to accommodate the stress that is pulling it apart, a single weakness in this type of material compromises the integrity of the whole, and it splits or shatters. This is how concrete breaks, which was a big headache for the Romans. The Romans never solved this problem, and so only used concrete in situations where it was being compressed rather than stretched, such as in a column, dome, or the foundations of a building, where every part of the concrete was being squeezed together by the weight of the structure. Under such compression, concrete remains strong even when cracks form. If you visit the 2,000-year-old concrete Pantheon dome, you will see that over the years it has developed cracks, perhaps as the result of earthquakes or subsidence, but these cracks do not endanger the structure because the whole dome is under compression. When the Romans tried to make suspended floors or beams of concrete, which had to withstand a bending stress, they would have found that even the slightest crack causes the structure to collapse. When the material on either side of the crack is being pulled apart by its own weight and the weight of the building, it has no way to resist. So to use concrete to its full potential, as we do today, to build walls, floors, bridges, tunnels, and dams, this problem had to be solved. This didn't happen until the European Industrial Revolution hove into view, and even then the solution came from a very unexpected source. A Parisian gardener, Joseph Monnier, had a liking for making his own plant pots. At the time, in 1867, these were made of fired clay, meaning they were weak, brittle, and expensive to make, especially if one wanted large pots to accommodate the craze for growing tropical plants in glasshouses. Concrete seemed to offer the solution. It could be used to make huge pots much more easily than clay because it didn't need to be fired in a furnace. It was also cheaper for the same reason. But it was still weak in tension, so in the end, his concrete pots cracked just the same as terracotta. Joseph's solution was to embed loops of steel inside the concrete. He couldn't have known that cement bonds very well to steel. It could easily have turned out that the steel was like the oil in the vinaigrette of concrete, preferring to keep to itself. But no, the calcium silicate fibrils inside concrete stick not just to stone, but also to metal. Concrete is essentially a simulacrum of stone. It is derived from it and is similar in appearance, composition, and properties. Concrete reinforced with steel is fundamentally different. There is no naturally occurring material like it. When concrete reinforced with steel comes under bending stresses, the inner skeleton of steel soaks up the stress and protects it from the formation of large cracks. It is two materials in one, and it transforms concrete from a specialist material to the most multipurpose building material of all time. Something else Joseph couldn't have known at the time turns out to be one of the keys to the success of his reinforced concrete. Materials are not static things. They respond to their environment, and especially to temperature. Most materials expand when they get warmer and contract when they get cooler. Our buildings, roads, and bridges expand and contract like this, observing day and night temperature cycles as if they are breathing. It is this expansion and contraction that causes a lot of the cracks in roads and buildings, and if it is not taken into account in their design, then the stresses that build up can destroy the structure. Any engineer guessing the outcome of Joseph's experiments might have assumed that concrete and steel, being so different, would expand and contract at such different rates that they would tear each other apart. That in the heat of the summer, or in the depths of winter in Joseph's garden, the steel would break out of the concrete, causing the pots to rupture. Perhaps this is why it took a gardener to try the experiment at all. It just seems so obvious that it would not work. But, as luck would have it, steel and concrete have almost identical coefficients of expansion. In other words, they expand and contract at almost the same rate. This is a minor miracle, and Joseph was not the only one to notice it. An Englishman, William Wilkinson, had also happened upon this magic combination of materials. Reinforced concrete's time had come. Go to any of the world's many developing countries and you will find that millions of the poorest people live in shantytowns built of mud, wood, and corrugated steel roofs. These dwellings are very vulnerable to the elements. They are oppressively hot in the sun and leaky and unstable in the rain. They are regularly destroyed by storms, washed away by floods, or cleared by bulldozers in the service of the police and the powerful. To build a stable defense against the elements and those who would oppress you requires a material that is not just strong but also fire, storm, and waterproof, and, crucially, cheap enough for everyone in the world to afford it. Reinforced concrete is that material. At £100 per ton, concrete is by a long way the cheapest building material in the world. But it also lends itself to mechanization of construction and so allows further cost reductions. One person and a concrete mixer can build the foundations, walls, floors, and roof of a house in a few weeks. Because all of these elements are part of the same structure, it can easily last 100 years in all weathers. The foundations protect it from water infiltration and are impervious to insect and mold attack. The walls will resist collapse and support glass windows securely. It needs very little maintenance. The tiles will not be blown off it because it has none. The roof is an integral part of the structure, and vines, plants, and even grass can be grown on top of it for sustenance and to thermally insulate the building. The fact that such flat roof gardens are only possible thanks to concrete's reinforcing steel internal skeleton, only domes like the Pantheon would be possible otherwise, is a pleasing salute to one of its gardener inventors. As work continued on the shard, I found I no longer needed to visit the viewing window cut into the hoarding at the site itself. In fact, this afforded me the worst view. All the action was now at the top of the growing tower. I got the best view from my roof, and it soon became a habit for me to get up in the morning and contemplate the shard's progress with my morning coffee. I started measuring how it had grown with a chalk mark against the chimney stack. It went up, up, and up. At the peak of activity, I calculated that the engineers were adding approximately a whole floor every few days. What made this possible was that the concrete was being continually cast. It arrived by truck at the bottom of the building and was pumped up into a mold at the top. Meanwhile, the mold, which was the size and shape of a floor of the building, was fitted with steel rods that would become the internal skeleton of the concrete tower. Once a floor had been cast, it was then used to support the mold, which was moved up a story, ready for the next floor to be cast. And so the process was repeated. This building was growing. Growing, I calculated, at a rate of 3 meters a day. What was more staggering to me was that this bootstrapping process could seemingly continue for as long as you cared to move the mold up another floor and pour in more concrete. It was like a bud on a growing sapling. In reality, though, there are currently limits to the process. The engineers of the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, which is almost 3 times taller than the shard, found that the capacity of the machinery to pump concrete vertically to the top of that tower proved to be a severe problem. Nevertheless, the method is ingenious. The mechanization of the process of building is what makes concrete such a modern material. It lends itself to pouring and molding, to the rapid building of vast structures. The big structures of old, such as the stone cathedrals of Europe or the Great Wall of China, took decades to build. The central core of the Shard, one of the tallest buildings in Europe, took less than 6 months. The material enables you to think big, to dream. It is the material that has allowed the ambition of civil engineers to be realized. The Hoover Dam is built from reinforced concrete, as are the Mio Viaduct and Spaghetti Junction. One day, the Shard stopped growing, and then, over a matter of days, the paraphernalia of the concrete mold disappeared. What was left was a concrete tower 72 stories high. It was grey, raw, and wrinkly, like a newborn. Work began at the bottom again, while the newest concrete tower in London swayed quietly in the wind, with seemingly nothing to do but watch while human ants swarmed at its base. But it was not idle. Inside the material, the fibrils of calcium silicate hydrate were growing, meshing together and bonding with the stones and steel. The tower, in doing so, was getting stronger. Although concrete reacts with water to harden to a reasonable strength within 24 hours, the process by which this artificial rock develops its internal architecture and so its full strength takes years. At this moment, the concrete core of the Shard continues to harden and strengthen, albeit imperceptibly. Once at full strength, the concrete structure will take the weight of the 20,000 people who will be inhabiting it by day. It will take the weight of all their thousands of desks and chairs, all the furniture and computers, as well as tons and tons of water. It will do this day in, day out, without visibly deforming. The floors will remain rigid and solid, and it is capable of supporting the building's occupants and protecting them from the elements without complaint for thousands of years, if the concrete is looked after, that is. Because despite reinforced concrete's impressive credentials as a building material, it does need care. In fact, its vulnerability has the same origin as its strength, its internal structure. In ordinary circumstances, exposed to the elements, the steel that is used to reinforce concrete is prone to rusting. When that steel is encased within concrete, the alkaline conditions create a layer of iron hydroxide on top of the steel, which acts as a protective skin. But during a building's lifetime, arising from normal wear and tear and the expansion and contraction that takes place during winters and summers, small cracks will appear in the concrete. These cracks can allow water inside, water that can freeze, expanding and creating a deeper crack. This type of attrition and erosion is what all stone buildings have to put up with. It is also what mountains have to put up with, which is how they get eroded. To prevent stone or concrete structures being similarly afflicted, maintenance of their fabric needs to be carried out every 50 years or so. But concrete can suffer from a more pernicious type of damage. This occurs when lots of water gets into concrete and starts to eat away at the steel reinforcement. The rust expands inside the structure, creating further cracking, and the whole internal steel skeleton can be compromised. It is particularly likely to happen in the presence of salt water, which destroys the iron hydroxide protection and rusts the steel aggressively. Concrete bridges and roads in cold countries, which are regularly exposed to salt, such as is used to clear snow and ice, are vulnerable to this type of chronic deterioration. Recently, London's Hammersmith flyover was shown to be suffering from concrete decay of this kind. Given that literally half of the world's structures are made from concrete, the upkeep of concrete structures represents a huge and growing effort. To make matters more difficult, many of these structures are in environments that we don't want to have to revisit on a regular basis, such as the Öresund Bridge connecting Sweden and Denmark, or the inner core of a nuclear power station. In these situations, it would be ideal to find a way to allow concrete to look after itself, to engineer concrete to be self-healing. Such a concrete does now exist, and although it is in its infancy, it has already been shown to work. The story of these self-healing concretes started when scientists began to investigate the types of life forms that can survive extreme conditions. They found a type of bacterium that lives in the bottom of highly alkaline lakes formed by volcanic activity. These lakes have pH values of between 9 and 11, which will cause burns to human skin. Previously, it had been thought, not unreasonably, that no life could exist in these sulfurous ponds. But careful study revealed life to be much more tenacious than we thought. Alkaliphilic bacteria were found to be able to survive in these conditions. and it was discovered that one particular type, called B. pastorii, could excrete the mineral calcite, a constituent of concrete. These bacteria were also found to be extremely tough and able to survive dormant, encased in rock, for decades. Self-healing concrete has these bacteria embedded inside it along with a form of starch, which acts as food for the bacteria. Under normal circumstances, these bacteria